Welcome to Everyday Theology, where we don't tell you what to believe or why to believe it, but rather explore our Christian beliefs and why they matter for us in relation to God, to creation, and to others. My name is Aaron Ross.
Welcome back to Everyday Theology. Today, I have another one of those guests that I always say I am super excited for. And of course, I'm super excited, but on many different levels this time around. I have Professor Dr. Mark Cartledge, who is very special to me and my wife. Him and his wife officiated our wedding. We've become friends over time by going to academic societies and I guess I'm lucky and blessed to call you friend. I don't know if you would call me friend, but maybe I've just done something weird.
Yeah, I can say friend. That's not a problem.
Oh, good. Woo. Just dodged that bullet. And for my listeners, just so they know, Dr. Cartledge, he is the principal of London School of Theology. He has previously taught at University of Birmingham and Regent. He has written more books than it's fair for someone to write. And I would encourage you to go look at his full list of publications, which doesn't even show up. You have to click another link when you go to look at his bio to see the full list of publications because it's just far too long. But those publications are around a lot of practical theology and recently now the public life and the digital church and so many fascinating things. But he's just brilliant. And Dr. Cartledge, thanks for joining me today.
It's great to be with you, Aaron. Thank you for the opportunity to chat together and have it recorded. This is kind of fun. We have all sorts of conversations together, so it's nice to do it in this particular way.
Yeah, so we should have recorded some of the past ones. I think, you know.
Well, yes and no. That might not be worth recording, but some of them would have been certainly fun to listen to.
Yeah. So you've got a new book out, The Holy Spirit in Public Life. And we'll get into that a little bit, but before I do, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself to my listeners, anything else you want them to know, like things I missed, like that you're a minister in the Anglican tradition, anything else that you can think of?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've had a fairly varied and interesting sort of life, really. I've been all over the place, done all sorts of things. So I studied theology at London School of Theology. It was called London Bible College back in the 1980s, where I met my wife, Joan. We both studied theology together. And I then, after a year doing an internship in a church, I trained for ordained ministry in the Church of England, went to another college called Oak Hill. And during that time there, I was beginning to pick up what would become a very important strand to my own interests and academic work. I did a research degree looking at prophecy today, so the charismatic renewal in the Church of England and the gift of prophecy. And I completed that in the parish. I went on to be a parish minister working up in Liverpool, the Liverpool area. And then Joan and I went to Nigeria, both taught in a seminary, an Anglican seminary in Nigeria for a short time before coming back. And then I was involved in campus ministry, university chaplaincy work in the UK, as we call it, both at Liverpool University and then subsequently at Durham. And it was during this time I completed my PhD, which was on the area of speaking in tongues. And that piece of work was both theological in the sense that I, you know, read biblical texts and did some historical work and some systematic work, but I really also did some empirical work. So I went out to congregations and I, you know, interviewed people and I conducted a questionnaire survey and things like that. And I learned how to do that side of work, which I'm happy to talk about in a bit more detail. And then while I was in Durham, I was both part-time chaplain to St. John's College, but also teaching in Cranmer Hall, which is the Anglican training wing of St. John's College. Like it's the hall that is the ordination training. And there I began to teach more practical theology, started off in New Testament and moved to practical theology. and from there I went to Lampeter in Wales, doing work around ministry, Doctor of Ministry, and then from there to Birmingham, because there was a center in Pentecostal and Charismatic Studies, mm-hmm. and I was invited to apply for a job and happened to get it, which is somewhat of a surprise to me. And then eventually succeeded Alan Anderson, being the director of the Center for Pentecostal and Charismatic mm-hmm. Studies. And from there, I go to Regent University, which is a whole completely different world. Enjoyed living in Virginia Beach, well, just outside Virginia Beach, Chesapeake. And then at the end of 2019, we come back to the UK, back to our home, and back to LST. And I'm now, we call it principal in the UK. In America, it would be president. So I'm the CEO of an institution, but I also do some teaching and research supervision, and a little bit of, well, some research. I can try and keep that going, although there's a struggle to do that. And my life is really sort of taken up with leading an institution with colleagues, my executive team colleagues, and working with faculty friends and staff colleagues and friends as well. And I really enjoy working with students. You know, I've always enjoyed working with students, so I really enjoy working with LST mm-hmm. students. They're great, great fun to work with.
Which, it's a good thing that you got to Birmingham, because without you, yeah. who knows if I would have been accepted into Birmingham, since that was your doing before we knew each other.
That's right. I was a postgraduate admissions tutor in the School of Philosophy, Theology and Religion when you applied. And I happened to say, yeah, okay. Let's
have this begrudgingly.
If we find someone who will supervise him, that's the first thing. And if we can find somebody, yeah, can we have? And yeah, that's right. And, so I did the paperwork.
It's a good thing that you were at Regent. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been able to officiate our wedding. Which That's was the true. Last thing you did in the States.
It was the last thing. It was just, yes, right. We flew down to Florida before flying home. Yeah, that was great fun. It was a great privilege to be involved in that.
So I want to start with that kind of question, right? I mean, you know, my trajectory, and having taught a lot of undergraduate students, primarily in confessional spaces, confessional institutions, there's this kind of misnomer with practical theology and what it is, right? Mm-hmm. And so very often, even my last institution, they would call practical theology, it was more like pastoral theology, right? Mm-hmm. It was more like, when we think about baptism, what do we think about it and how do we practice it? Mm-hmm. And that's, there's a place for that, but it kind of muddies the water when we say doing practical theology. And so I would kind of start with just a question. What actually is the discipline of practical theology for those who may not be aware of what it is and what its aims are and what it tries to accomplish?
Yeah, so it looks slightly different in different places. And that's, in a sense, what you're reflecting. So some years ago in the International Academy of Practical Theology, there's always a conversation about what it is, but there was a discussion around three areas. One was formation and ministry as an element of it. And that states and in other places. So this is about training people to be pastors and church leaders. So it's associated in that particular genre, if you like, with skills for ministry. How can we help learn how to preach and lead pastoral conversations and all that kind of stuff? So often referred to as a clerical paradigm, it has its roots in that particular tradition. But certainly from the second half of the 20th century, it began to broaden out and become much more about practice. And it's not restricted to pastors and the clergy vocation. It goes beyond that. And it's about church. It's about how to congregations live out the Christian vocation in the world. How do they witness to the gospel in the world? But also, how does the church relate to society? And one of the main strands within the academy that became prominent was a kind of liberationist approach to practical theology, where in a sense it became a sort of arm of or a dimension of liberation theology that that focused on liberation or liberative practices. So how can the church engage in this kind of transformative project around social justice and all of that. So you have this liberation side. Also alongside this, the third strand, which really has roots into the earlier 20th century, which is really about, well, how do we go about researching these communities? What tools do we need? What resources, what approaches do we need to actually understand communities? And so you have this interface then coming into conversation between the social sciences, sociology, anthropology, social psychology, and how they can serve the empirical research of communities. So we have the whole congregational studies thing emerging and becoming very popular, both in the sociology of religion, but also within practical theology, because you have theologians who say, well, wait a minute, in order to read a community, we need people who can read them theologically, not just sociologically.
Right.
And so there's a whole move that really emerged, and it has its links to the Chicago School in America, but it also has, and Don Browning and his work on fundamental practical theology. But in the European context, it has its links to particularly Nijmegen, Hans van der Ven, and the empirical research of religious communities and religious individuals, using both qualitative interviews, observation, qualitative methods, but also quantitative methods. So doing surveys and number crunching and creating conceptual and statistical models that begin to explain attitudes and beliefs. The point is, in practice, it's actually researching people in their beliefs and practices kind of it together. And it has an abstract and a very intellectual conceptual side to it, but it also has a very practical side, in the sense that practical theology should, as a normative discipline, return to practice.
Yeah, right.
And there are different models and processes for how to do this. But at the end of the day, it is about theology and practice. How do we read the contemporary theology that's lived theology? How can we engage with it critically and constructively? And how can we revise it, renew it, in order to improve it and develop it in terms of the church's practices in terms of its own internal life, but also in relation to society?
Yeah.
Now, when I was in Birmingham, a colleague, of course, Stephen Patterson, joined from Cardiff. He was developed called the Doctorate in Practical Theology, or the Professional Doctorate in Practical Theology. And that was really about practitioners who were engaged in professional practice and not necessarily in the church. So it was very broad in who could actually be part of this, but they had to be able to use theological resources in the reflection on professional practice. And that's now very popular in the UK. Hmm. And so in many respects, the whole idea of reflective practice has been particularly important. So I often say there's three levels for me. There's the skills-based training level. There's the pastor who's wanting to reflect on practice, his or her own pastoral practice, and improve it. But then there's also the research side. So people who want to go and research communities and research issues in society. That's a very long answer to a very short question. But hopefully it will help your listeners to appreciate what I think practical theology is.
Yeah. And I don't want to minimize it all, because honestly, I would say, you know, the work of theology proper, whatever that might mean, isn't nearly as complicated in some ways as the work of practical theology, in the way that you've talked about it. Because I can stick in my head, right? And you do this, of course, as well in your own theological work. But, you know, I can theorize and gain some information and kind of, but when you get into practical theology, you have to be able to do that as well as reflect on communities, understand practices, and re-engage those communities, as you're talking about, and in helpful ways. I mean, maybe to put it this way for my listeners too, the church, in my opinion, would be lost without practical theologians who do this kind of work that help us understand why we do the practices that we do and what that looks like moving forward in relation to our own kind of theological
experiences and engagement, right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think it's really important to read not just texts. And it's obviously, we read biblical texts, really important. We read historical right. texts. We read academic texts, formal academic texts, of course. But it's really important to read people.
Right.
And, you know, how many theologians are very good at reading the Greek New Testament, but can't read the congregation that's sat in front of them when they're trying to preach?
A lot. You know, I mean,
you know, at the end of the day, we have to read people. And if you can't read your community, or if you can't read the people in front of you, it's going to be very hard for you to connect with them, communicate with them, and enable them to be influenced by the ideas that you're hoping to use. So I think it's hugely important that, you know, but I mean, as Jeff Assey would say, we need theologians to read communities, because it's sensitive to the lived experiences and beliefs that people have.
And yeah,
there's that sensitivity that we're, you know, theologians are attuned to believers and what believer. Now, not always. I mean, you can visit a completely different tradition and be like, I'm on another planet here. I do not know what's going on. But you can also, in a sense, well, hopefully gain some expertise in particular traditions that then allows you to read them. And my own work has focused on Pentecostals and charismatic Christians. That's the community I've researched the most within the whole framework of practical theology.
And maybe this is like a great kind of turning point. And we can talk about whether it's an example from your recent book, The Holy Spirit and Public Life, or another example, maybe to kind of turn that to say, we've talked about the theoretical, how do we try to understand practical theology? Maybe give my listeners an example, right, of something in the work that you've done that has helped do this very thing. Read the people, understood the people, tried to help kind of craft and shape the practical realities of that group.
Yeah. Okay. So when I think about a congregational study I did some time ago, which was actually in Birmingham, this was a Assemblies of God community. And so I found myself going into that community and being part of that for about 6 months. And at the time I was working on the whole notion of ordinary theology, which is the idea that theology is not just written by theologians in textbooks or general articles, but actually theology is simply a reflection on belief.
Right.
And reflect on the belief, but that belief is not informed by formal educational processes. And what we have actually are many so-called inverted commas ordinary believers who are very reflective about their beliefs and their faith and what they do.
Right.
And so what was really fascinating is for me to go in, and I conducted some focus group work. And what was really interesting was to connect my observation of congregational worship to testimony people were having. And one example would be the whole area of conversion. And in the Pentecostal tradition, of course, people talk about conversion, followed by spirit baptism, or if you're a Wesleyan, a sanctification followed by spirit baptism. We won't right. maybe get into the threefold versus the twofold work thing. But conversion is important, and people were given. So because testimony is so important in a Pentecostal church, people love to give testimonies, and space is given for people to tell the stories. I began the focus group process by inviting people to give testimonies. And one of the things was that came out of this research was people started to listen to each other's testimonies. And in some of the testimonies, because it was in a focus group, people were sharing slightly different experiences.
Right. And
so it provides a sort of very rich texture to the kind of narratives that were being produced. And that, I think, then had an impact on how people were sharing their testimonies within the church itself. So come a Sunday morning, you know, there was, I think, a direct sort of spin-off Now, it wasn't something that I expected to happen, but it's something that just emerged naturally as people were focusing on testimonies. Now, in conversion, what was really interesting, there's a theorist called Lewis Rambo. It's a very unfortunate. The guy called Lewis Rambo, who's written a book called The Theory of Religious Conversion, and it's a standard text, and it goes through many stages. And I was then able to theorize the narratives in light of his kind of account. But always what happens with practical theology is once you take the narratives of folk and you begin to interrogate them both theologically and in this case sociologically, you always come to the question, how does this impact our understanding of conversion? And what does that mean? And so one of the recommendations that I was able to say at the time was, well, you know, this is how you talk about your conversion. So maybe, or your conversion narratives, maybe in light of what Rambo has said and some of the biblical examples we looked at, maybe there's ways in which you might think through how you then operationalize your strategy around evangelism.
Yeah.
You know, what are the things that you can learn about how you present the gospel, how you live out the gospel, how you connect with your local community in a way that makes sense? So there was a genuine, I hope, my memory is there was a general conversation that then came out of that research. I think this is particularly important where you have something called action research, where there's a collaboration between the researcher and the people who are being researched, so that they kind of work together in a kind of collaborative way, such that the recommendations that come out of research can then be acted upon in a very practical way.
Yeah, sorry. I think there was a little pause there because of a connection, but I think that's really important for us to reflect on. I mean, I think it was Roger Olson and Stanley Grins talked about this idea of what they called folk theology, right? Like there are beliefs, whether they're taught or not, there are beliefs of communities and religious communities, particularly in their case, Christian communities. And I think it's really important when you talk about this, especially with conversion, and actually engaging with that process, right? The personal process, the communal process, and that in light of research, right? And having this kind of larger conversation. You know, I think far too often, particularly in the Western church, and particularly in charismatic and evangelical Pentecostal spaces, even though those are kind of three distinct things, just mushing them all together for a second, is that we take personal experiences and often create theological dictations for others based on personal experiences, right? So this is how I was saved. This is how it happened for me. This was my conversion experience. And so now, therefore, since I'm now a pastor or I'm now a leader, this is how it should be or how it must be for my congregation. And if it looks anything different, it's either not right or it's suspect, right? And I think without the work of practical theology, we could be at a loss because we'd have these spaces that aren't reflected upon or we're not actually engaging. In fact, I think we do see that, right? When we find communities that do not kind of try to understand their own self, their own communal self, their own kind of leader, you know, the leader doesn't try to understand that's very common, right? And that we have these kind of subsects of people that this is how it has to be.
Yeah. And I think there is a strand of practical theology that says, well, it's not just about the leader being self-reflective on his or her own practice. It is actually a corporate kind of thing that we do. And helping congregations to reflect together about how they do what they do, I think is a really important thing. But also, I think there's a translation question here, which again, we might come on to when we talk about public theology as well. But here the translation question is around how can we take fairly academic and technical studies that build quite sort of in-depth theories about, for example, conversion, filter them theologically and in a sense dialogue with those and maybe even revise aspects of them. and then translate them into a way that is actually accessible to communities that they can operationalize in meaningful ways to enhance their practices and become more effective in how they witness. So yeah, there's a whole range of issues here, I think, which are really, really important.
Yeah, and maybe let's get on to, you know, my question to you in the sense of what's been one of the most surprising issues, or what's been one of the most kind of like, I don't know, even personally surprising when you've researched and all of a sudden you've had that kind of like, oh, this is an issue that we've not been reflective on and we must get into this.
So I suppose this is the, journey into public theology. So when, some years ago when I was at Birmingham, I was fortunate with a colleague to study mega churches in London. Mm-hmm. We began to sort of map out the number of mega churches. Now, we define a mega church as attracting over 2,000 people per week,
right,
for the purposes of members, just attendees. And as we began to map the field in mega churches in Britain, and it's small compared to the States, at the time we did the study, it was about 10 in the UK, and most of them were in London. So we found ourselves considering mega churches in London, and most of them were migrant-led churches.
Hmm.
Now, that wasn't a surprise, but then we discovered actually there are two non-Nigerian-led churches that are actually Church of England churches. Now, the idea that the Church of England would have mega churches perhaps comes as some surprise. And I think the interesting thing is that there are some very successful Church of England churches, and functions on a parish basis. But in London, of course, the dynamics of a mega city mean that things change, the dynamics of the geography mean that the whole thing changes, and it's a globalized city. So I think one of the surprises is actually once you get into a subject area and a particular geographical location, you find yourself being pulled and pushed in all sorts of ways. And I think that you just have to be open to what are the issues that emerge from a particular context. So what happens with people who do practical theology very often is they'll go into a community setting, a congregational setting, and simply ask a very basic question about a particular issue. What's going on here?
Yeah, right.
And you can't prejudge the answer to that. I mean, and if you could, then it's not really research. If you know the answers before you do it, you know, it is a process of investigation. So what's going on here? And there's loads of surprises. I mean, both little surprises, but also fairly big surprises, because until you start actually talking to people and finding out what they do and how they think, then you could find yourself sort of just making a lot of assumptions that are just not fair and not true. So certainly with mega churches, it was fascinating to learn how they functioned as churches and the kind of issues they faced.
Yeah. Yeah. What are some of those, right? I mean, and it's definitely a different context. I would, you know, while I've got listeners all over the world, I would say most of them are from the United States. So our issues, our things are quite a bit different, even if we don't think that might be the case with the short flight to the UK. So what would be a couple that you would say were really the most surprising?
Yeah, I think one of the surprising issues was the project was on social engagement, and we were exploring that. And one of the things that one of the churches had developed a very serious approach to social engagement. They had developed a whole bunch of projects that were interconnected and it developed. So the amount of energy and work that had gone into social engagement in the area was phenomenal. Now, we didn't realize just how much was going on, because until you actually, you know, as I say, get into a community or set of communities and find out what's going on, you don't really know. And a lot of the work that churches do aren't always advertised. You know, they're doing some sensitive work. So, for example, There was one church that was working with the police and working with hostels for women in the sex trade and women who'd been trafficked for sex work. And inevitably, because that's such a sensitive area, they weren't advertising certain things, understandably, but They were having a very significant impact on a particular geographical area because of the work they were doing. And you know, until you actually kind of get into the community and begin to start talking to them, because it's not obvious from the website. It's not, I mean, for very good reasons, you know. They were doing an amazing piece of work, and of course, increasingly we're becoming much more aware of the whole trafficking question. So with a globalized city like London, it just gives again those narratives around human trafficking. That was something that was not hidden, but not as obvious as it could be, and it became really quite a significant element for one of the churches in particular. I think the whole globalization question was also, everybody talks about globalization, but actually, When you go to a multicultural city like London, it is truly a globalized city. The world has come to London, and London is connected to the rest of the world. And I think just understanding or getting a glimpse into that really does have an intersections of different cultures and races beliefs that come with that as well. There are different theological beliefs that are imported and then become kind of like hybrid beliefs as well. There's a hybridization going on as well, which is also fascinating.
It's interesting to think about, you know, that topic of, well, both topics, right? So starting with the topic of sex trafficking in the church and thinking about the ways in which the church in different areas have very much kind of worked in this space to help how we can. And we live in this tension, it feels like, between wanting people to know the work of Christ within the larger community in areas like this, and also recognizing whether we can't or whether it feels boastful when we try to. Right? And it seems a bit to me that those who have the hardest time with this are the larger churches. And again, that may be an unfair assumption, but only in the sense that it can feel very markety, right? Like we're just marketing to more people. You should come here because look at what we do, versus we just want people to know what we do because of our love of Christ. And if anyone wants to participate, we want more participation, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a huge challenge with megachurch studies generally, because megachurch studies, one of the interesting things is the whole idea of kind of commercialization, really, and branding. And megachurches have come under a lot of criticism about a kind of McDonaldization. This is about franchise. This is about big numbers. This is about, you know, and I think it's a really interesting question around what you brand and how you brand it. There is pushback as well, because some people are saying, look, you know, I'm fed up with this kind of branding, this McDonaldization world, and how churches are just basically, you know, corporations with a CEO, you know, and they market a particular product in a particular way. And that's what people go to consume. You know, people are mass consumers. And there is an interesting question around all of that. There are some people who really do resist that. And there are some folk who say, well, I can be part of a megachurch for a season, But I'm going to then go to a smaller church. And there's some fascinating sort of examples of people who have been involved in a mega church for a while, and then decided they need something a bit more intimate in terms of the size. They want something that's more local to where they live. They want to connect the world of work with the world of worship and their locality. So there's an interesting set of questions around all of that, I think.
So I guess the other kind of part of this question then, right, is not the branding thing, which I know would take us way too long to get into, and really what help does it have currently? I think it is something that needs more work into, but particularly more in the States, probably. Yeah, I think we have a larger problematic area to engage with. But when we talk about kind of that turn to public life, right? Like the church's work within the public world, you know, your new book here on the Holy Spirit and public life is trying not to just surmise the practical, right? The quantitative, here's how it happens, but really, where is the Spirit intersecting? Where, how do we think about this in relation to the Spirit? I mean, I know why you might be interested in that question, but maybe for the listeners, why were you interested in that question in the various different areas that you study this? And what helpful came from thinking about, you know, this in a different way, right? Because I would say it's probably a lot more common for people to think, well, what does Christ have to do with things, right? And a lot less common to say, what does the Spirit have to do with things? And those have vastly different implications, as much as people may not be aware. So again, what brought you to that question? And maybe let's talk about one of those sections in your text, whichever one you find that you would think most appropriate for this.
Yeah, so thanks for that. So one of the questions that was emerging out of the megachurch project was looking at public theology. We wanted to find a framework for bringing together different forms of discourse. So around social science, humanities, and in particular theology. And public theology was an obvious sort of field to kind of place ourselves, which is what we did. And one of the concepts that's often associated with the public is the idea of the common good. What's beneficial for everyone, really? And so you get into issues around common grace and the work of the Spirit in creation. What's the relationship between the work of the Spirit in creation and the work of the Spirit in the church? And so when I first moved to the States, one of the very first writing projects I gave myself was asking the question, if we look at biblical texts and in relation to the Spirit and the church, is it possible to connect them to a broader public theology idea like the common good? So you discover that in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 7, Paul talks about the gifts of the Spirit being given to the body for the common good. Mm. And what's really interesting about that text is that Paul's borrowing the idea of the common good from outside of Christianity, the body politic,
if you like,
and he's using it within. And so I did a reflection on that particular passage. And as I sort of began to engage with it with the lens of public theology, I began to realize that actually the gifts of the Spirit, there's a case to be made for the gifts of the Spirit not just belonging within the confines of the church, but as believers who are also citizens, not just disciples, they are citizens of a society. They take with them their gifts into that broader society, because that's who they are. They carry their giftings with them, and as they carry and spill out into other public domains, so they bring those gifts, and those gifts are given for the common good. They're used in practice for the common good of others, whether that's in healthcare, education, public service, or whatever it is.
Right.
So that began me on a journey of saying, well, wait a minute, if the Holy Spirit is empowering the church, well, individual believers with their giftings, what about if the Spirit empowers the church to engage with this common good outcome? And so the empowering of the church for the sake of the common good became one of those strands in the book. It's one of the frameworks I use. And the second one I kind of bring in is one is up for a kind of beneficial kind. The other one is, well, wait a minute, you know, it's not all sweetness and light here. There are problems because the church isn't always treated very well at the hands of the society or the culture or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I then looked at the paraclete sayings in John's gospel, the five paraclete sayings. And it's a slightly more difficult set of texts because John sets up this kind of conflict between the world and the church, or the world and the disciples.
Yeah.
But the paraclete is the one who mediates the presence of Jesus and is with them and walks alongside them. So by analogy, I kind of propose that the church is the community of God that walks alongside the world in critical dialogue as a kind of critical friend.
Hmm.
And there's, in the book, I developed that by saying there is a worldview clash here, but actually the church is called to walk alongside the world and both resist the evil, resist the bad, if you like, and bless the good, whatever's good in society, to bless it, but also to be that critical component. And this is something that, you know, Maltman talked about years and years ago. It's not entirely new in that way. But using the paraclete sayings, I think, in this way was new. So for me, those are two strands that are like the framework that the church is called to walk alongside society in a critical and constructive way in the power of the Spirit. So that's the pneumatological ecclesiology coming through.
Yeah.
And by the gifts of the Spirit in the body that spill out into society for the sake of the common good. And then the final strand, I illustrate that, but the final strand as I bring it together is to say, well, you know, how do we maintain this common good, this critical companionship? They're the two things. And I kind of bring them together by saying, for me, it's about being truthful with love. It's the Ephesians 4 text. But actually the church, not something else, authentically the church, and to do so lovingly, but also truthfully. So being truthful with love is the posture by which we hold together this walking alongside, as well as the blessing for the common good. So that's how I kind of do it in the book.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you say that, in the sense that in your time in the States, and again, this is more of just a generalized statement, but, you know, you probably saw what is common, which is the church focuses primarily on the critical part, right? Whatever it is that we can call out, and that's become a part of that kind of culture wars of the West and everything. The church is often publicly more vocal, and I would say almost primarily more vocal about the things that it wants to critically call out in society, or call wrong or evil, and sometimes correctly and sometimes very not correctly, right? But it's not that great at doing the other part, which is walking alongside of society and calling out the good things that are happening. And I wonder if that's somewhat because there's this still reformed tension that has found its way in the church, in which anything outside of the church, doesn't matter what it is wrong anyways. Right. So there is nothing good out there. It can only be, you know, is that correct? Like, is that kind of that tension there that you see?
I think it's certainly stronger in the US.
Yeah.
And I think in the US, from my experience at least, and this is where I might be slightly controversial, I lived in the US for 5 years, so it's from my experience of living there. There's such a polarization politically and culturally, and you talked about the culture wars. And the idea of middle ground, of coming together, a place of meeting whereby, you know, there is this walking alongside in such a way as to listen, is really quite hard.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are kind of ideological bundles on either side of the divide. And if you don't kind of keep the bundle together, you're expelled from the tribe, really.
Right.
And that's kind of hard, because what happens if the tribe is so problematic in the first place? You know, where's the critical reflection that would say, well, wait a minute, you know, we can affirm this aspect, but not that aspect.
Yeah.
But because it's bundled, you can't untangle the bundle. You're not right. allowed to untangle the bundle, because you are betraying the side, you're leaving the group. And so you have this, you know, and it's just incredibly politicized in the US in a way that I think is unhelpful. In the UK, secularization is further down the track. We have a state church, but its impact on culture is not as strong as it is in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think, it seems to me as though, you know, Europe is a much more secularized place than North America. And so we don't expect to have the same voice, I think, as American Christians have in their society. I think we've got to the stage now where we know we're a minority. We are, yeah. You know, Christians are a very clear minority. I mean, you know, it may well be there are state occasions and the king's going to have a coronation. It will be in Westminster Abbey,
right.
And there's all the pomp, right. And all, you know. But at the end of the day, you know, there's less than 5% of people who are regular churchgoers every week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's our reality. And of that, probably 2% maybe would be evangelical Pentecostal type folk. So, you know, we are in a small minority now, and we don't have the cultural power that American Christians have in their own context. So
yeah.
We don't expect, I think, what a lot of American Christians expect, because it just is not our reality. So
yeah.
We have to find ways of, in a sense, being a witness from within and not expecting to have our voices heard or understood. I mean, I think the key question for us is religious illiteracy is so rampant now. People genuinely don't understand religious folk.
Hmm.
And so you have to kind of work on the translation element. How can I communicate and live in such a way as to make a case for faith in Christ? Because
yeah.
Most people simply do not understand what that means.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that we're, you know, in the States, we're on that path. I mean, clearly we see that, right, with church attendance dropping below 50%, or at least claimed church attendance, right? Gen Z, millennials fleeing, as it were, from the church. We're definitely on that path. And I think there's so much to learn from the work, even from the studies of the megachurch in the UK, that are going to be applicable to our churches in the US in the next 10, 15, 20. Like, it's got legs to go, because we're on that path. And in fact, I have a bit of research more to do on this, but there's some studies coming out that actually shows that the secularization of the church in the US is being propelled by the, how do I say this sensitively, by the far, far religious right that have married their politics with the church. And that's actually propelling the secularization of the church in the US, which is a fascinating thought, though I can't say that it's correct. It's just more of a kind of research coming out. But I say all that rambling to say the work that you're doing, especially within the UK, is going to have a telescoping lens for the church in America to go, this is what's coming. Because we have found ourselves in this space that we have, that we think that we have the power over culture, and it's only diminishing more and more, yet we still think we do. Right? So,
yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, we can blame, you know, Constantine and Calvin and all these people for assuming that we could build a Christian state. But actually, you know, we are notionally a Christian country in England, because we have an established church, but we know culturally that, you know, that's far from the reality. And we have learnt, or we are learning, to live in such a way that, you know, we know we're a minority voice. But actually, in some ways, you know, throughout the history of the church, you know, the church has often been a minority voice. In many parts of the world today, the church is very much a minority voice. And the key question is, well, what does it look like to be authentic in discipleship? And what does it look like to be positive in citizenship? They're not the same thing. We are citizens of heaven.
Yeah.
But we do have a role to play within our you know, within our own societies, that's for the common good, that is for the benefit of everyone. And I think that to be in that place is to adopt a non-defensive posture, a non-sectarian posture.
Hmm.
And that's hard when you're feeling under pressure. That's hard when you're feeling victims. But actually, I think it's a really important posture for the sake of your own health, you know, the church's own health, that we are, you know, we can make a very positive contribution, but also for the gospel as well, because it means that we're positive people for the sake of the gospel and the power of the gospel to change societies. I mean, you know, historically, there are people who've had huge impact on society because of their faith. And, you know, why can't we see that again?
Yeah. And that's a topic that I think we could go on for a long time. I'd actually love to chat more about that, but I need to be respectful of your time because I know that you've got a busy schedule.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for taking the time. We'll definitely have you back, especially on that topic. I think we've got to talk more about that, but thanks again. And well, before I let you go though, where can people kind of follow along with your work? Where can they buy some things that they might be interested in reading from you? Where's the best place?
Amazon obviously is the place to go for books. So just put my name into the Amazon search and my books will come up. You can go to the LST website for my profile and the list of publications, as you've mentioned. I'm a bit more, I'm not very good on social media. I do have a LinkedIn account. So if you want to search for me on LinkedIn, that I'm on there. And so occasionally I post on LinkedIn. But I'm not very active, which I probably should be more active, but time is limiting. But so the LST website is the key place. And then obviously Google my publications on Amazon, and then you'll get most of them.
And as a very shameless plug, I will plug that London School of Theology for my American listeners is a great place if they decide to get a master's or even a PhD. It is a great place to go and study. So
you've given me the opening to do some marketing. Yeah, LST, we have a whole bunch of undergraduate degrees. We're starting a new degree in BA Theology and Liberal Arts. So if you're a prospective undergrad and you want a 3-year degree, not a 4-year degree, and you want to do it in London, London's a fantastic place. And LST is on the tube line. We're in Greater London. You can get into Central London in 30, 40 minutes on the tube. This is a fantastic place. And a new MA in Practical Theology, we're probably going to call it, the name's up for grabs at the minute, but probably something like Theology, Ministry and Practice. So if you want to do that, that's fully online. And we have a whole bunch of biblical studies, theological studies, and master's degrees as well. And it is a great place to do research degrees as well. We have about 50 to 60 research students, which is pretty good for a kind of seminary. We're for American listeners, we're a cross between a sort of Christian college and a seminary. And it's a little bit different to the US system. Mm-hmm. So we have undergrad degrees and postgrad degrees all together in the same single institution. We have about 300 and something students. So we're relatively small compared to some US institutions, but we're a pretty vibrant place. So please do, go on the website, check out our programs. That would be fantastic.
Perfect. Well, Dr. Cartledge, again, thank you so much for taking the time, and we'll hope to speak soon.
Okay, thanks so much.